Hello, you are tuned into Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territory of the Musqueam people at UBC. My name is Alirad Amari, and I'm joined by my co-host today, Gurman Gill. Each week on Research Review, we interview a researcher who is affiliated with the UBC community and discuss some of their latest work and findings and how they relate to broader issues in society.
Hello, everybody. We would like to welcome Dr. Andrea Bunden to Research Review today. Dr. Bunden is assistant professor at UBC School of Kinesiology. Much of her research focuses around the sociology of sport and critical disability studies. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you very much. Pleased to be here.
Excellent, Dr. Bunden. So thanks for joining us. One question I had just to start off, I was looking at your educational background and noticed it's pretty interesting. So you did your undergrad at the University of Calgary. That's where you got your bachelor's, and then you came to UBC, did your master's, followed by your PhD, all in the field of kinesiology. So I was just wondering what really drove you to go into this field straight from undergrad and really like continue it so long up to getting your doctorate.
Yeah, I think it was actually sort of pure accident. It was never really my plan to enter academia. When I was in final years of high school and thinking about what I wanted to do, I was an athlete myself, and all of my coaches had done kinesiology degrees. Many of my teammates had done kinesiology degrees. So sort of for lack of a better idea, I headed to Calgary, which has a fantastic kinesiology program and just a lot of sports teams. I enjoyed it, but I didn't know what sociology of sport was. Kinesiology is very interdisciplinary. So I took a lot of like physiology classes and biomechanics. And then in my final year, I had this one sports sociology class, and it just sort of clicked that this is what I was interested in. And I found my way at UBC because they had a great rowing team. Full honesty, that was the extent of my research. I knew they had kinesiology and I knew they had a rowing team. So that's how I ended up here for my master's and stuck around, as you said.
Yeah. What drove you in particular to critical disability studies?
Yeah, that was also a chance encounter. I was doing a master's here and I was interested in athletes and health behaviors. And I had to recruit for my master's project. And I really wanted to make sure I was talking to a diverse group of athletes, so including some athletes with disabilities. And I knew there was a local para-Nordic ski team that skied out of Cyprus, a cross-country ski team. I was also a cross-country skier, so I figured that would be a good chance. And I went to meet them on the ski trails with the hopes of recruiting one or two to my study. And the coach said, sure, I'll let you pitch your study. You can try to recruit from the team, but by the way, we're short a guide for one of our blind skiers. I need you to fill in before you can talk to them. So I ended up jumping into their training session and guiding one of their skiers who she's visually impaired. And we had a really great time. And she called me back the next week and said, you know, I'm actually looking for a new guide. Do you want to keep coming to our practices? So I always joke that I went there to recruit them and they actually recruited me. And it was through my involvement with that para-Nordic ski team that, you know, I was skiing with them while I was doing my studies. It really sparked my interest in disability studies and disability sports specifically. And yeah, it changed the trajectory of my life actually.
Yeah, I noticed you went to the Paralympic Games as a Nordic ski guide. Like, what was that experience like?
Yeah, well, it was that woman, Courtney Knight, who, like I said, she called me and said she was looking for a guide. After a few sessions, she said, well, I'm actually trying out for the Paralympics in 2 years. I think this was 2008. And of course, the games were coming to Vancouver in 2010. And I thought, well, we'll see how this goes. And we ended up qualifying for the team. So I was her guide in 2010, which was just like an incredible experience because it was Vancouver, you know, our hometown for both of us. It was her fifth Paralympics, I believe, although previously she'd been a track and field athlete. So this was her first Winter Games. It was my first Games ever. And I mean, it was just fantastic to be in that environment with these incredible athletes and also just a culture that really like values disability, and where, you know, we sort of say that at the Olympics, everybody looks the same. I know that's not exactly the case, but at the Paralympics, everybody is different. And that is just such an incredible experience to see people pushing their limits, but each in a very unique way. So yeah, that was, I raced with Courtney in 2010, and then she retired. And actually one of our teammates from 2010, her guide, retired after those games. So we partnered up and went to the Sochi Paralympics together as well.
Oh, interesting. So 2010 Olympics and Paralympics in Vancouver, 2014 Paralympics in Sochi. Yeah. Were you involved in any other Paralympics? Might I say like recently, right now, there's the 2022 going on, I guess, right?
Yeah. And now purely as a fan, occasionally a volunteer with the local club. 2014 was, I finished my PhD in 2014 and I moved to the UK for a postdoc, and the UK does not have much snow. So it was very hard to continue. Plus the athlete I was guiding in 2014, she also retired. So, you know, it seemed like a good time. No one else needed me. Yeah.
Just one question for our listeners, a general question, talking about the Paralympics. How exactly do the Paralympics work? Because I know that they occur a little bit time after like the Olympics themselves. It's kind of a separate thing, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a bit of a debate in the community. The Paralympic Committee will tell you that para means parallel, that it runs parallel to the Olympics, but entirely separate. Of course, most of us know the term para to reference paraplegia, and that probably is the origins of the name. But like I said, more recently, it's assumed to be parallel games. So it starts, you're right, it's about 2 weeks after. And it runs as a completely separate event, although there is an agreement between the Olympic Committee and the Paralympic Committee that when cities bid on the games, they are bidding on both games. They must deliver both games. So there's certainly closer ties than there have been in the past. But all of the athletes at the Paralympics have some form of disability. There's about seven different types of impairments that are included, visually impaired being one of them. And like I said, about six or seven others. Although within each of those groups, there's a ton of variation.
Yeah, so shifting into your research, what sort of problems are you looking to solve in particular?
Well, the thing that really struck me from my time skiing with Courtney, like, keep in mind, we're driving out to Cyprus and Whistler. We're spending a lot of time talking together. We're the same age. We were both athletes. We grew up very similar backgrounds, and yet we'd had this like extremely different sport experience. Sport for me was always something just really comfortable. Like I loved it. I thrived in sport environments. She loved sport, but she didn't get the same opportunities I did, and often faced discrimination and just really demeaning comments about her sport participation. So we talk about this, and like, that's what struck me, is that like this thing that I had experienced as being so positive in my life actually is not always positive for everyone. Based on ability, gender, race, all sorts of different difference. And in fact, you know, when I started to talk to Courtney, I also realized that maybe my experiences that I thought of as positive, you know, I certainly faced gender discrimination or saw how women's sport is devalued, right? So it was like talking through some of our experiences together. So when you say like, what's the problem I'm trying to solve? Ultimately, I want to promote sport, but I also want to make sure that sport is worth promoting, that it's that it lives up to that sort of positive potential, and that we can make sport a space that celebrates difference.
Excellent. We'll be right back here on Research Review after one short message, so please stay tuned.
And about 40% of UBC students experience food insecurity. Sprouts is hosting a weekly produce market from 10:30 to 1:30 every Monday in the Life Building. With produce from local farms, students are free to take whatever they want. Sprouts Cafe is open from Monday to Thursday and is offering 30 free meals a day, completely free and no questions asked. They also host Community Eats, a completely free hot lunch that is open for all. Stop by and support the Sprouts cause for sustainable, accessible food at UBC.
You're listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Ali Rotten, along with my co-host Guru Mann. Today we are interviewing Dr. Andrea Bundin, an assistant professor at UBC School of Kinesiology. So far, we talked a bit about how Dr. Bundin entered the field of critical disability studies and her past involvement with the Paralympics. So going on, Gurman, I think you have something to ask.
Yeah, I know, just going off of one thing you said, I noticed your lab got a Shirk grant to study women in Paralympic sport. Is there a particular reason why you think women's roles in Paralympic sport are on the decline?
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. So this is actually comes back once again to my own experiences of the games. I was a, as I said, guide for female athletes. And yet at the start line, at one of the games, I was the only female guide. At another games, I was one of two. And I started looking around being like, it's not just like, there aren't many female guides. There aren't many women in the wax rooms. There aren't many women coaching here. And I started looking at the number of athletes and found that, so at the Winter Paralympics, it'll be about 25% women athletes this year. At the Summer Paralympics, it's a bit better. It's about maybe 30%. But at the Olympics, you keep hearing, oh, it's the women's games. It's the women's games. We've reached this gender balance at the Olympics. And in fact, there's like slightly, I think this game starting next week in Beijing, there'll be a few more women than men at the Olympics. So why have we reached gender balance at the Olympics, but not the Paralympics? And when we started looking into this, what we saw is that there had been this progress of sort of like women, more women participating, and then all of a sudden it stalls. And what we realize is that there's a lot of different things happening here. But one of them is that people seem to have trouble holding two different sort of social justice issues in their mind at the same time, right? So because the Paralympics is like focused on disability equity, which it absolutely needs to be, it seems like sometimes gender equity actually gets pushed to the back, isn't a priority. Or so we see like countries, many countries, a dozen countries, 20 countries, sending teams to the Paralympics without a single woman on them. If this happened at the Olympics, it does happen occasionally at the Olympics, and those countries get shamed for not sending like one woman. At the Paralympics, this is normal practice. So on one hand, we're sort of like congratulating countries for building their disability sport programs, but not necessarily supporting them to make sure those disability sport programs are actually inclusive in other ways. That's one thing. And then the other thing is the sports that are in the games, in the Paralympics, are often closely linked with certain impairments that are not gender balanced. So spinal cord injury, the highest rate of spinal cord injury is young men. Many of the sports in the Paralympics are for individuals with spinal cord injury. That itself is not a problem. I'm thrilled that individuals have a chance to participate in sport, but like we really need to be looking at what are the sports we're including? What are the impairments we're including? And then how does that come together for a big picture at the games to make sure you're actually creating opportunities for women with disabilities?
Yeah, I would imagine a lot of the issue would come with funding, because I know there would be issues with funding for Paralympic sport, and there's also issues with funding with women in sport. And I would just imagine the intersectionality of the two together would just make it so much harder.
Yes, that's exactly it. You're facing, it is about intersectionality. It's about understanding that disability and gender and race and nationality and geography, that none of these are ever separate things. And that when you start looking at how women with disability are positioned, they're facing a lot of challenges to make it to the games. And the pathways, it doesn't take a lot for sort of a pathway to become just completely blocked or absent, right?
Now, you know, touching upon this issue of representation in the Paralympics and all that, one other question I have is that how did this matter of representation come down to the countries which are involved in the Paralympics? Because I was just looking at some statistics right now, both for the Winter and Summer Paralympic Games, and it appears that the countries that are performing best, the athletes are performing best in the Paralympics, it seems to be mostly, you know, wealthier countries that are well off. And I would assume this is just because of the programs that exist and the types of support that exist. So two questions I really have is that how does the broader issue of representation look, and how would you say that, you know, Canada works to support our Paralympic athletes, both in like the Summer and Winter Games?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I mean, Canada is a leading Paralympic nation. You know, I certainly have high hopes for our team in Beijing. But I also don't want to paint an overly rosy picture of parasport either in Canada, because I've got another research project that's ongoing right now about national team athletes' experiences during COVID. And one of the things we're finding there is that our Paralympic athletes have not received the same support during COVID that our Olympic athletes have, or that they faced additional challenges that haven't been accounted for. But generally speaking, we have a strong Paralympic team. We participate across the board in, you know, most of the sports. We've got very good male potential. There are still inequities, though, in Canada. And, you know, right now, I'd say one of the big ones is if you're in a major city versus a rural community, that will have a substantial impact on your ability to participate in parasport. If I just give you an example of something like wheelchair basketball, which is actually one of the more popular sports, right? So first of all, start thinking about how many wheelchair users there are compared to the general population. Then start thinking how many of them want to play basketball and are maybe at a point in their life where this is something they can spend time doing. You're still only going to end up with, even in a city like Vancouver, like a small number of competitive athletes. That doesn't create a lot of opportunities to get a lot of tournament play. And it doesn't create a lot of opportunities for women in wheelchair basketball to get a lot of, so you're dealing with small numbers. And Canada being such a big geographic country does pose a lot of challenges. Just connecting the people with the program is one of our big challenges. And then you're asking about like geographically, how this might work out. Absolutely. There are challenges. I mean, parasport in African nations, there's a few very, very strong programs, teams, some fantastic athletes. But when we were interviewing for our Women in Parasport program, I mean, we were realizing that a lot of these programs, the person we were talking to on the phone is also the person running the practice, is also the person going to recruit someone at the local rehab hospital. Like they're just not at a stage of development where sending athletes to the games or more than one or two athletes is really feasible. They need a lot of work just building the infrastructure. And of course, attitudes towards disability are different nation to nation, culture to culture. So, you know, unfortunately, it remains true that in many cultures, people with disabilities are not encouraged to participate in public life. And that includes like sporting life, recreation. There's still a lot of stigma attached to disability. So even sort of connecting with the individuals who might really want to participate and encouraging them in the society to like understand that this could be a really positive experience, that remains a challenge.
Definitely.
Yeah, I know that, for example, women's soccer is often used as a measure for gender equality, and I found that really interesting. I would imagine the same thing could be done with the Paralympics. Just the success in the games in itself is, I would imagine, just a measure of attitudes towards disability.
I think that's a really smart comment. Yeah, it's going to tell us everything, but it would be a little bit of an indicator about how much a nation is actually investing in disability and people with disabilities and in opportunities for people with disabilities. Yeah.
Excellent. We'll be right back here on Research Review after one short message, so please stay tuned.
The Indigenous Committee at UBC presents Indigenous and Cultural Day, celebrating authentic Indigenous art of all forms. The event will feature several exhibits at the Student Nest Building, spanning from beading to showcases highlighting Indigenous-led businesses. Mark your calendars for April 11th at 12:30 p.m.
You are listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Alirod, along with my co-host Gurman. Today we're interviewing Dr. Andrea Bundin, an assistant professor at UBC School of Kinesiology. So in the past bit, we've talked a bit about the representation of women in Paralympic sport and how overall it's working towards gender balance. We also touched upon other inequities which are present, which create barriers for those who want to participate in sports. So going forward, Gurman, I think you have something to ask.
Yeah. Do you feel like many Paralympic athletes are like activists or advocates for increased inclusion and diversity in sport, or are they just like more focused on competing?
This is something I done a bit of research on. In fact, it's been a bit of a thread through some of my research that absolutely, there are athletes with disabilities, Paralympians, who are extremely strong advocates for their communities and for disabled people. But this isn't always the case. And I actually am kind of feeling hopeful right now that we're at a bit of a moment where we're going to see more Paralympians take a stance on matters that matter to them, or and really start championing disability rights in a very public and vocal way. But there is a strong, what I call, and some other scholars would call, athletes first narrative, which is this notion that I want to be seen as an athlete. I want to be acknowledged for my athleticism first, not as a disabled person. I understand a large extent to where that's coming from. I mean, all these Paralympians are athletes. They're incredible athletes and they should be recognized as athletes. But where that narrative is tied into a lot of really what I think are damaging stereotypes that, you know, we value athletes. So of course you want to be seen as an athlete, and we stigmatize and discriminate against disability. So it, that sort of putting athlete first can unintentionally actually devalue disabled identities, I think. And we do hear that quite a bit still from Paralympians. Like I said, I understand individually where they're coming from, but if we want to use the Paralympics to advance disability rights, to advance social justice, I think that requires the Paralympic community really actually connecting more with disability issues and saying, you know, this is something that matters to us. It's core to our movement.
Yeah, I can imagine the added stress that would have on athletes who just have this entire identity aside from them being an athlete. I would imagine a lot of athletes are just like, this is not what I signed up for. I'm here to compete.
You're absolutely right on that. I mean, it is, I can't speak from personal experience here. I have to be very, very clear, but certainly from my engagement with athletes, like having to go to an event and constantly have to advocate for what you need or remind people what you need, or, you know, speak up for yourself, that is tiring. And it's a reason many athletes drop out of sport. It does have, it's extra work. But actually, what I found in some of my research is that it's also a lot of work for people to deny identities and disabled identities, gender identities, sexual identities. Like, athletes can also take a lot of strength from, you know, we say like being your all, bringing your whole self to the games. And I think that's when I said, I think we're at like a moment here. When I was watching the Tokyo Olympics and Paralympics this summer, I certainly saw a lot more athletes at both the Olympics and Paralympics who were taking stances or who were, you know, proclaiming their identities as gay, as immigrants, as racialized people, and as people with disabilities, and actually like owning those identities and saying they were proud to represent their community. And I don't think those athletes saw that. I don't think. I'm speculating here, but like, was that an extra source of stress, or was that actually, like I said, I hate the word empowerment, but a positive experience to be able to be at the games, representing their communities and representing the issues that matter to them. So, you know, that I do have a position here. I would love to see Paralympian athletes who can draw on the disabled community and on disability identities as a source of strength.
Yeah, I mean, that is a lot of what the Olympics is about. At least that's what we're taught in elementary school. It's about all these countries coming together and accepting each other for who we are and all that, kumbaya. So it would...
Wouldn't that be like... a night? That would be a great game if that all happened.
Yeah. So like, ideally, I would imagine this would be the perfect opportunity for that sort of position to be taken.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, there's always a way of talk about like whether or not we should combine the Olympics and the Paralympics. Like, if all athletes are equal, why don't you just hold one games? And, you know, my take on that is that that would work for some athletes with disabilities. But I think we'd actually be giving up a lot. I think we would be losing what makes the Paralympics a unique event.
That's true, yeah.
So, you know, I kind of like that they happen after. I like that they've got their own space. And I thought London was very clever in their marketing. When London hosted the games, they had the Olympics. And then the day the Olympics closed, I think it was actually at the closing ceremony, their big commercial was, "Thanks for the warm-up, guys. Here comes the games," right? And that's, I have to admit, that's how I'll be watching Beijing. You know, the Olympics, great, love it, but I'll be excited 2 weeks later.
Definitely. Do you think that, so like the spacing, the 2 weeks is interesting, because I remember like back in 2010, we had the Vancouver Olympics, that was in February. And how long are the Winter Olympics usually? Like 2 weeks, right?
I think there were 14 or 16 days.
16 days. It's actually pretty short when you think about it. So then it ends 2 weeks. And then it was sometime in March 2020 when we had the Vancouver Paralympics. So what are your thoughts on that spacing? Do you think it could be like shorter, longer? The Paralympics could go before the Olympics.
Yeah.
Like some things could be done with that.
It's debated all the time, right? Because it is... in some ways it is an awkward spacing, right? Like you kind of, you remember the energy of Vancouver and then you get this lull and then you get this next event coming. And that can be hard for like volunteers to maintain the energy, stuff like that. But I'm not sure there's a better alternative. If you put the Paralympics before, the concern is that actually the host might not invest in the Paralympics. They're always rushing to finish things.
Oh, yeah.
And you're not... I'm not convinced yet that they would do the same job. I would love to think they would, but I'd be worried about the Paralympics going first and things not being ready. That would be one concern. The other issue is actually, I think, concern is not the right word, but respect for the athletes and the preparation. And that's that. So like I said, I competed in the Vancouver. The day the Olympics ended, or maybe 2 days later, you know, the Olympians leave, we moved into the village. Mm-hmm. So those 2 weeks that, you know, for the audiences watching TV, there's like nothing on. Those are actually when the athletes are arriving, they're checking out the venues, they're getting over the jet lag. So it's actually the logistics. It would be very hard to tighten that because you'd have to have like your Paralympic athletes are stashed down the road, ready to move into the village right away. And they wouldn't get the access to the venues and sort of all that. So I think 2 weeks was chosen for more practical reasons than anything else.
That makes sense. That does make sense, like from a logistic perspective when you talk about it. One other question, just throwing that out there, because you mentioned that when cities bid for the Olympics, they're kind of doing a joint bid for the Olympics and the Paralympics, even though they're technically like separate events. What would you think would happen if they were actually bid separately? So you have like one place doing the Olympics, you had another place doing the Paralympics. Would that maybe, you know, like serve to increase awareness around the Paralympics maybe, since it's like more excitement around something going on somewhere else?
Yeah, I actually think that for the first time, that might be a great idea. And my reason for it, so originally, obviously, the Olympics had the bigger profile. They're the moneymaker. Countries wanted the Olympics. But if you've been paying attention to the news recently, countries aren't that excited to host the Olympics anymore. Yeah. It's hard to find a host these days.
It's expensive.
They're so big. Yeah, they're so expensive. A lot of countries are like, it's too big a gamble. I mean, Tokyo, nothing through no fault of their own. They lost a ton of money there, right? So the Olympics aren't that attractive actually right now for a lot of nations. I actually think the Paralympics could be attractive. They're a far more manageable size. They do come with a cost, but they can also be used as a real impetus to improve your accessibility. So, you know, even in Vancouver and Whistler, like the facilities we built for the games, as well as like many of the facilities that were retrofitted, are now a lot more accessible to people with disabilities. Like, so in terms of like the return on the money spent, it got a lot of projects that we probably should have done anyway, done faster because we had the Paralympics coming. So I could see nations like positioning themselves going, hey, here's a smaller event. We can get really excited about it. It's great spectating, but it's a bit more manageable. And it also has this like underpinning social value that we want to invest in. So I actually think that right now, if we were going to go that route, and I unfortunately don't think it could be the time to do it. I also think that the pandemic has taught us to rethink everything we know about hosting.
Definitely.
And that like, yeah, you know, we might be considering what size of venues we need, how many spectators you actually need in a building. Do we need, yeah. So I think right now, all event hosting is kind of up for debate. And this might be the moment to relook the Olympic Paralympic model.
Definitely. Like this is a bit of a tangent now, but personally, I just feel like in the future, large sporting events, international ones like Olympics, Paralympics, FIFA World Cup, it's just going to be much more distributed. You might have several different countries, different cities agreeing to host it. Just with the piece you were touching about it just getting so bloated and expensive and no one really wanting to like touch this thing. If you kind of break it up, I feel like in a way you could create more global interest as well. I feel like it's getting more countries, more communities involved in this. It could actually have more positive impact rather than just like large countries, large cities, wealthier ones being able to participate in that.
You're absolutely right. I mean, and that has been a model during COVID to some extent of having like different championships for various selections, or because this part of the world is able to host an event, so they hold something European only, or like it can be fantastic for the local economy. You can, like I said, it's a little bit more manageable. You can get more local spectators. Interestingly enough, it's also probably better for the environment from a sport and sustainability perspective. And this is, it's not my research, but I am a member for the Center for Sport and Sustainability. And we have had researchers within our group who've looked at, you know, even at UBC, how our varsity teams travel. And if you think about it right now, you know, we like our football team flies to Montreal and plays one game and then they fly back and then they fly there. A tournament where people come together is actually, and you play multiple games within a tournament, mm-hmm. is actually environmentally a better option. Some people would still argue you shouldn't be traveling at all. It's still not a like net zero option, but looking at models where people can like, oh, we could take a train to that event and we're only going to have athletes here who can take a train to that event. actually makes a lot of sense for many reasons.
Excellent. We'll be right back here on CITR 101.9 FM with Research Review, so please stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Confused, aka Julie B, aka Zigzag Stardust, aka the host of Musician. I would really love it if you could tune in every second Friday from 11 a.m. till noon and hear me turn the stuff that inspires me into weird audio improv. There's sound collages, there's local music, there's hot off the presses hit tracks, and it's waiting. It's for you. It's for us. It's made by us. So get at me, come on in, and stay inspired in the meantime.
You're listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. And today we're interviewing Dr. Andrea Bundon, an assistant professor in UBC School of Kinesiology. My name's Alirad, and along with my co-host Gurman Gill, in the past bit we've been talking a bit about the pressures which athletes face as they have to advocate for themselves while at the same time participating in sport, and we also touched upon the relationship between the Olympics and the Paralympics. So going forward, Gurman, I think you had something to ask.
Shifting gears a little bit into another area of your research, what is life like for Paralympic athletes once they retire?
Yeah, this is something I did some research in when I was in the UK on my postdoc working with the English Institute of Sport. And the project actually came from their, what we call their performance lifestyle team, which is a team that, like, they're not psychologists, they're not coaches, they're these individuals who work with athletes through various transitions in their lives. So when they first make a national team and when they're starting to go on the senior team stuff, as well as when they retire. And what we were hearing from these performance lifestyle advisors was that, like, I'm not sure I'm really serving the Paralympic athletes well. Like, I'm talking to them about transitioning out of sport, about retiring from sport, but I get the sense that, like, I don't actually know what they're transitioning into. And so I spent a year interviewing retired athletes, retired Paralympians, about what it was like to leave sport. And, you know, some of the stories were actually really, really tough, really tough. It would have been tough for athletes in general. It's a major part of their identity. And then to suddenly stop sport is big. But what we found with Paralympic athletes specifically was that some of them said, you know, at the Paralympics, I actually operate in this kind of bubble where my disability was valued. Like, that's why I was on the team. That's how I came to be on the team. I was, like, headhunted for this sport. And then I left sport and went looking for a job and realized that people with disabilities still face a lot of discrimination in the workforce. And I wasn't really prepared for that because my experiences in sport had been, like, quite different. So that was one big area. We also encountered a lot of athletes who had become injured and then were very, very quickly recruited into sport. So, you know, they had a spinal cord injury and someone recruited them from the rehabilitation hospital. They weren't even out of the hospital. And someone was, like, recruiting them to a sport team. And they had this, like, really rapid rise through the sporting ranks. That was fantastic, this fantastic career. And then that career ended and they realized that, like, psychologically, they hadn't really come to terms with their injury. And this was, like, the first time they kind of, like, slowed down and realized this, like, this very dramatic impact this injury had on their lives. So, yeah, you know, in addition to everything that athletes normally deal with, and we often talk about, like, a post-Olympic blues and stuff like that, they also have this added layer of just, yeah, having been in this Paralympic space that had a quite a different view of disability. And then, like I said, facing discrimination or just facing mentally on their own, like, understanding what it'd be like to live as a disabled person without sport.
Definitely. Like, one question I just have for you. So when athletes are, you know, basically during that time that they are athletes, they are participating in sport. What is it like? Are they full-time athletes or are they also still working, doing other stuff?
A bit of both. So in the research I just talked about in the UK, what we found there was that prior to about 2008, mid-2000s, basically prior to London being announced, London being, what year was that, 2006? Someone will have to check that for me. But prior to London, most of them were not full-time athletes. Most Paralympians were not full-time athletes. They were often working or students. And then with the announcement of London, the UK started to invest in para sport a lot more. And suddenly they were getting the similar stipends. Canada has a similar model for our national team athletes. They were getting funding to do their sport. Most of them were not getting amazing funding, but it was enough that they could like maybe take a semester off school or not work for the year before the games, things like that. I would say most of them still had some employment or some other source of income, might have been their families. Canada's very, very similar. We see that increasingly Paralympians are able to be full-time athletes, but like, I don't even really like that word full-time because like, I considered myself a full-time athlete and a full-time student. Like most of them are still doing the same training as the athletes that might be on sponsorship. But they're not always getting the same money and they might also be doing something else. So it is a bit of a mix, but there's more of a shift towards, let's say, sport as their main source of income. That is shifting. Yeah.
Yeah. What sort of careers do retirees usually pursue after they retire?
I'm not sure there's any generalization I can make there. I mean, like us all, they've got different interests. They go into different things. But what I will say is we did find in the UK, and I think this is many want to pursue careers in sport in some form or another. So it could be coaching. It could be working with athletes as a physiotherapist. It could be working in sports media. But I mean, that's common of Olympic athletes as well. Obviously, if you love sport and you have passion in sport, you might want to stick around in some capacity or another. What we did find though in the UK is that although many Paralympians wanted to work in sport, there's actually a lot of barriers to working in sport, and that's sort of one of the unspoken assumptions in Paralympic sports, that the athletes will be disabled, but the staff will not be. So we did a small project, but looking at coaches with disability, like how many Paralympians might actually go into coaching. And there's a few, and there's maybe a few more now, but yeah, that unfortunately is an area that we really need to be challenging. I think that, you know, they've got the skills to be athletes, but why are they not being appreciated and hired within sporting organizations for other roles?
Yeah, that really surprised me. While you're talking, I sort of assume that coaches for Paralympic Games are usually disabled or have some similar disability to the athletes, so it'd be easier to coach.
You would assume so. Like, it would make a lot of sense to have individuals who've actually done the sport who have the same impairment. And it does happen. And the sport that happens, well, there's a couple sports, but one that happens more frequently in is wheelchair rugby. And my theory here, well, I've spoken to many of the wheelchair rugby coaches as well, but is that, you know, wheelchair rugby is actually its own sport. It's not actually what we would know as rugby. It has the same name, but like, it's very, very different than what you're probably familiar with for rugby. It's played indoors. It's kind of like a combination of like basketball and rugby in a wheelchair. So it doesn't have an equivalent. So you can't just take your able-bodied rugby coaches and have them coach wheelchair rugby. It's a totally different game, different rules, different positions. Whereas there is an assumption that like, if you were a able-bodied swim coach, you can coach swimmers with disabilities. But it doesn't go the other way. Swimmers with disabilities are often assumed to not be able to coach able-bodied athletes. So there's still a lot of stereotyping that's happening there. The able-bodied people can coach disabled people, but not vice versa.
Yeah. We're sort of running low on time here, but is there any like last messages you want to get to the listeners?
The games are coming. They're exciting. I just watch and ask questions. I mean, the media coverage has improved, and you will be able to find this on TV, online, and get excited about the games. I think there's something really worth getting excited about there.
Definitely. Great.
Yeah. It was a pleasure to have you on. It was nice talking to you.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. And I love that you take the time to do this show. So thank you.
Thank you. Really appreciate having you on here. I think we learned a lot of things that we didn't know. It was a really interesting conversation. So glad to be able to touch on all that.
You had some great questions there. And I'm learning a bit from your podcasting style here.
So excellent. Thank you. This concludes Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Alirad, and along with my co-host Grimon Gill, today we interview Dr. Andrea Bunden, an assistant professor at UBC School of Kinesiology. We hope you tune in again to Research Review 2 weeks from now on Wednesday at 6 p.m.